Leave-taking.
26.
Before I continue my story, the private story of just one not particularly important or interesting young person in the Germany of 1933, I interpose here a brief word to the reader, in particular to that reader who feels, not without some apparent justification, that I have already overtaxed his interest in my insignificant person. Am I mistaken? Or can I hear some readers who so far patiently followed my story beginning to riffle the pages of the book? A riffling that expresses the feeling, what is the point of all this? What concern of ours is the fact that in 1933, in Berlin, young Mr. XY feared for his girlfriend because she was late for a rendezvous, or that he was gauche in his dealings with the SA, or for that matter, as the next few chapters will reveal, that he was forced to say farewell to all his friends, his ambitions, and his fairly conventional immature opinions. After all, it seems that things of real historical importance were taking place in Berlin in 1933. If we are to be told anything, then it should be these things. What happened between Hitler and Blomberg, or Schleicher and Röhm, behind the scenes? Who really set fire to the Reichstag? Why Braun fled and Oberfuhren committed suicide? We should not be fobbed off with the private experiences of a young man who is not much better informed than we are, even if he was closer to the scene of the events. A young man who obviously took no part at all in these events and had no influence on them, who was not even a particularly well-placed witness. A weighty accusation. I have to screw up all my courage to confess that I still do not think it justified, and that I do not think I am wasting a serious reader's time by telling my private story. It is all true. I took no direct part in events, and I was not a particularly well-placed witness. Nobody can be more sceptical about my importance than I am myself. Nevertheless, please do not take this as a sign of vanity, I am convinced that by telling my private, unimportant story, I am adding an important, unrecognized facet to contemporary German and European history, more significant and more important for the future than if I were to disclose who set fire to the Reichstag, or what Hitler really said to Röhm. What is history? And where does it take place? If you read ordinary history books, which, it is often overlooked, contain only the scheme of events, not the events themselves, you get the impression that no more than a few dozen people are involved, who happen to be at the helm of the ship of state, and whose deeds and decisions form what is called history. According to this view, the history of the present decade is a kind of chess game among Hitler, Mussolini, Chiang Kai-shek, Roosevelt, Chamberlain, Daladier, and a number of other men whose names are on everybody's lips. We anonymous others seem at best to be the objects of history, pawns in the chess game who may be pushed forward or left standing, sacrificed or captured, but whose lives, for what they are worth, take place in a totally different world, unrelated to what is happening on the chessboard, of which they are quite unaware. It may seem a paradox, but it is nonetheless the simple truth to say that, on the contrary, the decisive historical events take place among us, the anonymous masses. The most powerful dictators, ministers, and generals are powerless against the simultaneous mass decisions taken individually and almost unconsciously by the population at large. It is characteristic of these decisions that they do not manifest themselves as mass movements or demonstrations. Mass assemblies are quite incapable of independent action. Decisions that influence the course of history arise out of the individual experiences of thousands of millions of individuals. This is not an airy, abstract historical construction, but indisputably real and tangible. For instance, what was it that caused Germany to lose the Great War in 1918 and the Allies to win it? An advance in the leadership skills of Foch and Haig, or a decline in Ludendorff's? Not at all. It was the fact that the German soldier, that is, the majority of an anonymous mass of 10 million individuals, was no longer willing, as he had been until then, to risk his life in any attack, or to hold his position to the last man. Where did this change of attitude take place? Certainly not in large, mutinous assemblies of German soldiers, but unnoticed and unchecked in each individual soldier's breast. Most of them would probably not have been able to describe this complicated and historically important internal process and would merely have used the single expletive, shit. If you had interviewed the more articulate soldiers, you would have found a whole skein of random, private, and probably uninteresting and unimportant reasons, feelings, and experiences. A combination of letters from home, relations with the sergeant, opinions about the quality of the food, and thoughts on the prospects and meaning of the war, and, since every German is something of a philosopher, about the meaning and value of life. It is not my purpose here to analyze the inner process that brought the Great War to an end, but it would be interesting for those who wish to reconstruct this event or others like it to do so. Mine is a different topic, although the mental processes it involves are similar. They may perhaps be of greater consequence, interest, and importance, namely the psychological developments, reactions, and changes that took place simultaneously in the mass of the German population, which made Hitler's Third Reich possible, and today form its unseen basis. There is an unsolved riddle in the history of the creation of the Third Reich. I think it is much more interesting than the question of who set fire to the Reichstag. It is the question, what became of the Germans? Even on March the 5th, 1933, a majority of them voted against Hitler. What happened to that majority? Did they die? Did they disappear from the face of the earth? Did they become Nazis at this late stage? How is it possible that there was not the slightest visible reaction from them? Most of my readers will have met one or more Germans in the past, and most of them will have looked on their German acquaintances as normal, friendly, civilized people like anyone else, apart from the usual national idiosyncrasies. When they hear the speeches coming from Germany today, and become aware of the foulness of the deeds emanating from there, most of these people will think of their acquaintances and be aghast. They will ask, "What's wrong with them? Don't they see what's happening to them, and what is happening in their name? Do they approve of it? What kind of people are they? What are we to think of them?" Indeed, behind these questions there are some very peculiar, very revealing mental processes and experiences whose historical significance cannot yet be fully gauged. These are what I want to write about. You cannot come to grips with them if you do not track them down to the place where they happen, the private lives, emotions, and thoughts of individual Germans. They happen there all the more, since, having cleared the sphere of politics of all opposition, the conquering, ravenous state has moved into formerly private spaces in order to clear these too of any resistance or recalcitrance, and to subjugate the individual. There, in private, the fight is taking place in Germany. You will search for it in vain in the political landscape, even with the most powerful telescope. Today, the political struggle is expressed by the choice of what a person eats and drinks, whom he loves, what he does in his spare time, whose company he seeks, whether he smiles or frowns, what he reads, what pictures he hangs on his walls. It is here that the battles of the next world war are being decided in advance. That may sound grotesque, but it is the truth. That is why I think that by telling my seemingly private, insignificant story, I am writing real history, perhaps even the history of the future. It actually makes me happy that in my own person I do not have a particularly important, outstanding subject to describe. If I were more important, I would be less typical. That is also why I hope my intimate chronicle will find favor in the eyes of the serious reader who has no time to waste and reads a book for the information it contains and its usefulness. On the other hand, I must beg forgiveness of the more casual reader who lends me his ear less critically and reads the story of an unusual life under unusual circumstances for its interest alone. I have tested his patience with this digression and others, in which I have not resisted the temptation to spin out some of the ideas that seem to me to follow from my story. How better to regain his favor than by quickly getting back to my narrative?